Chapter 24. As Second Advent conferences, prayer meetings, and social occasions were multiplying in various directions in the land, so in like manner opposition arose. Presidents and professors of theological seminaries, learned and unlearned, ministers and laymen, religious and political newspapers, and prejudiced individuals labored hard by fair means and foul to disprove what they called Miller's doctrine. Many of them assailed his character and denounced him in most violent terms. That they were unacquainted with his reputation and also the work in which he was engaged will be manifestly evident from the following extracts from his apology and defense. He dates his conversion from A.D. 1816 and says, quote, "I was constrained to admit that the Scriptures must be a revelation from God. They became my delight, and in Jesus I found a friend. I then devoted myself to prayer and reading of the Word. I commenced with Genesis and read verse by verse, proceeding no faster than the meaning of the several passages should be so unfolded as to leave me free from embarrassment respecting any mysticism or contradictions. Whenever I found anything obscure, my practice was to compare it with all collateral passages, and by the help of Cruden, I examined all the texts of Scripture in which were found any of the prominent words contained in any obscure portion. Then, by letting every word have its proper bearing on the subject of the text, if my view of it harmonized with every collateral passage in the Bible, it ceased to be a difficulty. In this way, I pursued the study of the Bible, in my first perusal of it, for about 2 years, and was fully satisfied that it is its own interpreter. I was thus brought in 1818, at the close of my 2 years' study of the Scriptures, to the solemn conclusion that in about 25 years from that time all the affairs of our present state would be wound up, with the solemn conviction that such momentous events were predicted in the Scriptures to be fulfilled in so short a space of time, the question came home to me with mighty power regarding my duty to the world in view of the evidence that had affected my own mind. If the end was so near, it was important that the world should know it. Various difficulties and objections would arise in my mind from time to time. In this way I was occupied for 5 years from 1818 to 1823. I continued to study the Scriptures and was more and more convinced that I had a personal duty to perform respecting the matter. When I was about my business, it was continually ringing in my ears, "Go and tell the world of their danger." This text was constantly occurring to me, Ezekiel 33, verses 8 and 9. I did all I could to avoid the conviction that anything was required of me, and I thought that by freely speaking of it to all, I should perform my duty and that God would raise up the necessary instrumentality for the accomplishment of the work. I prayed that some minister might see the truth and devote himself to its promulgation, but still I was impressed, "Go and tell it to the world. Their blood will I require at thy hand." I tried to excuse myself to the Lord for not going out and proclaiming it to the world. I told the Lord that I was not used to public speaking, and that I had not the necessary qualifications to gain the attention of an audience, and that I was very diffident and feared to go before the world, that they would not believe me, nor hearken to my voice, that I was slow of speech and of a slow tongue. But I could not get relief. In this way I struggled on for 9 years longer, pursuing the study of the Bible. I was then 50 years old, and it seemed impossible for me to surmount the obstacles which lay in my path to successfully present it in a public manner. One Saturday after breakfast in the summer of 1833, I sat down at my desk to examine some point, and as I arose to go out to work, it came home to me with more force than ever, "Go and tell it to the world." The impression was so sudden, and it came with such force, that I settled down into my chair saying, "I can't go, Lord." "Why not?" seemed to be the response. And then all my excuses came up, my want of ability, etc. But my distress became so great I entered into a solemn covenant with God that if He would open the way, I would go and perform my duty to the world. "What do you mean by opening the way?" seemed to come to me. "Why," said I, "if I should have an invitation to speak publicly in any place, I will go and tell them what I find in the Bible about the Lord's coming." Instantly all my burden was gone, and I rejoiced that I should not probably be thus called upon, for I had never had such an invitation. My trials were not known, and I had but little expectation of being invited to any field of labor. In about half an hour from this time, before I had left the room, a son of Mr. Guilford of Dresden, about 16 miles from my residence, came in and said that his father had sent for me and wished me to come home with him. Supposing that he wished to see me on some business, I asked him what he wanted. He replied that there was to be no preaching in their church the next day, and his father wished to have me come and talk to the people on the subject of the Lord's coming. I was immediately angry with myself for having made the covenant I had. I rebelled at once against the Lord and determined not to go. I left the boy without giving him any answer and retired in great distress to a grove nearby. There I struggled with the Lord for about an hour, endeavoring to release myself from the covenant I had made with him, but I could get no relief. It was impressed upon my conscience, "Will you make a covenant with God and break it so soon?" And the exceeding sinfulness of thus doing overwhelmed me. I finally submitted and promised the Lord that if he would sustain me, I would go, trusting in him to give me grace and ability to perform all he should require of me. I returned to the house and found the boy still waiting. He remained until after dinner, and I returned with him to Dresden. The next day, which, as nearly as I can remember, was about the first Sunday in August 1833, I delivered my first public lecture on the Second Advent. The house was well filled with an attractive audience. As soon as I commenced speaking, all my diffidence and embarrassment were gone, and I felt impressed only with the greatness of the subject which, by the providence of God, I was enabled to present. At the close of the services, I was requested to remain and lecture during the week, with which I complied. They flocked in from the neighboring towns. A revival commenced, and it was said that in 13 families, all but 2 persons were hopefully converted. On Monday following, I returned home and found a letter from Elder Fuller of Pulteney, Vermont, requesting me to go and lecture there on the same subject. The most pressing invitations from the ministry and the leading members of the churches poured in continually from that time during the whole period of my public labors, and with more than one half of which I was unable to comply. I received so many urgent calls for information and to visit places with which I could not comply that in 1834 I concluded to publish my views in pamphlet form, which I did in a little tract of 64 pages. The first assistance I received from any source to defray my expenses was $2 half, which I received in Canada in 1835. The next assistance I received was the payment of my stage fare to Lansingburg in 1837. Since then, I have never received enough to pay my traveling expenses. I should not have alluded to this were it not for the extravagant stories which have been circulated to my injury. From the commencement of that publication, Signs of the Times in 1840, I was overwhelmed with invitations to labor in various places, with which I complied as far as my health and time would allow. I labored extensively in all the New England and Middle States, in Ohio, Michigan, Maryland, the District of Columbia, and in Canada East and West, giving about 4,000 lectures in something like 500 different towns. I should think that about 200 ministers embraced my views in all the different parts of the United States and Canada, and that there have been about 500 public lecturers. In nearly 1,000 places, Advent congregations have been raised up, numbering, as near as I can estimate, some 50,000 believers. On recalling to mind the several places of my labors, I can reckon up about 6,000 instances of conversion from nature's darkness to God's marvelous light, the result of my personal labors alone, and I should judge the number to be much greater. Of this number, I can call to mind about 700 who were, previous to attending my lectures, infidels, and their number may have been twice as great. Great results have also followed from the labors of my brethren, many of whom I would like to mention here, if my limits would permit. Close quote. From the foregoing statement of facts, we learn first how deeply Mr. Miller's mind was impressed with the importance and necessity of proclaiming the doctrine of the Second Advent of Christ after his first 2 years' study of the Bible. Second, how that he continued to make the Bible his study 14 years longer under the same conviction that he must proclaim it to the world. Third, the peculiar and clear manner in which he was finally moved out to proclaim it, and then the final results of his labors, all go to prove that he was moved upon in a most extraordinary manner to discharge his duty by leading out in the proclamation of this important doctrine, and that too, as we have before shown, in the right time. The year 1843 was remarkable for signs and wonders in the heavens, so much so that people said those Adventists were the most fortunate people in the world, for they had signs in the heavens to help prove their doctrine. I will here name one that was seen by millions of witnesses, which I believe was supernatural. It was a brilliant stream of light which suddenly made its appearance in the path of the setting sun, a short distance above the horizon, soon after dark, and was very visible every clear night for 3 weeks in the month of March. While attending an evening meeting in Rhode Island during this time, the awfully grand and sublime appearance of this light was the cause of much excitement. During the time of this phenomenon, many sought to quiet their feelings by saying it was a comet, but without proof. I will here give a few statements from different authors selected from a small pamphlet entitled Modern Phenomenon of the Heavens by Henry Jones. From the New York Herald, quote, "The strange sign in the heavens, the mystery which continues to hang over this strange and unknown visitor to our usually quiet solar system, has very greatly increased the excitement in relation to it." Close quote. From the Hydrographical Office, Washington, D.C., quote, "The strange light. Soon after we had retired, the officer of the watch announced the appearance of the comet in the west. The phenomenon was sublime and beautiful. The needle was greatly agitated, and a strongly marked pencil of light was streaming up from the path of the sun in an oblique direction to the southward and eastward. Its edges were parallel. It was about 1 degree 30 minutes, or 90 miles broad, and 30, that is 1,800 miles long." Close quote. M.F. Murray, Lieutenant, United States Navy. Henry Jones makes the following statement concerning the appearance of this phenomenon in Connecticut. Quote, "On the evening of the 5th, 6th, and 7th, and 9th, instant, or commencing with Sunday evening last, the inhabitants of this town witnessed such a phenomenon as they had never seen or heard of, being seen for about the space of an hour on each occasion, and mostly between 7 and 8 o'clock. Just about in the west, on each of these evenings, the heavens being clear, there appeared a white streak of light, similar in color to the more common light in the north. It seemed about twice the width of the sun when in the same direction, and arose from the place of the setting sun." Close quote. East Hampton, Connecticut, March 10, 1843. He further says, quote, "Brother George Storrs, late of this city, and having recently called here on his way from the south, informs us that at Norfolk, Virginia, the late streak of light in the west, or the great comet, so-called, appeared of a blood-red color, that it caused great excitement among the inhabitants." Close quote. In closing his statement, he adds, quote, "With regard to further notices of the comet, I have before me a host of them in print which need not now be copied concerning it, all combining to establish the important facts that the same phenomenon was seen during about the same period, or 3 weeks of time, through the length and breadth of the Union and Eastern Continent, that it was something strange. In regard to the natural cause of this wonder of the world, I would be the last man to attempt to assign any other than that Jehovah himself is the sole cause of it, that he has done it by his own omnipotence to fulfill his word of promise concerning it, and to apprise his oppressed, cast down, and suffering saints that he is now very soon coming for their deliverance. Close quote. Should the reader desire any further facts about this strange light of 1843, or other signs equally startling, he can be gratified by reading the pamphlet referred to in this article.